A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
A new Netflix film captured imaginations this holiday season. Don't Look Up has become the second highest streamed movie ever on Netflix.
Here are the nominees for original screenplay. Don't Look Up, screenplay by Adam McKay, story by Adam McKay and David Sirota.
Everyone's been asking me whether I got the Oscar, like, $150,000 swag bag, which I didn't. Apparently that swag bag only goes to rich and famous actors and directors who don't need it. So
that's perfect. That's everything right there.
It really is.
We're joined by David Sirota. Last time David was on Deconstructed, he was talking about his podcast Meltdown, which is about the way that the financial crisis, and kind of more accurately, the failed response to the financial crisis, kind of paved the way to the crisis that we're in now. So I would suggest that if people haven't listened to that yet, I think it's only on Audible. Is that right?
That's right.
And so if you have Audible, check it out. If not, I actually ripped off Audible once by doing their like month free and then canceling it when I was done with that. Or to go back and check out the interview we did with David. But more importantly for this episode, David is the writer of, is that the actual credit or story by, like in Hollywood, they're very particular about what the exact credits are. So what was your credit for Don't Look Up?
So I shared the story by credit on Don't Look Up. So Adam McKay and I came up with the overall story of Don't Look Up. He wrote the script. I gave him lots of notes and we came up with a bunch of scenes. He wrote the script, but I was the co-story by credit.
And David's also the co-founder or the founder of The Daily Poster, which is now thelever.com, a kind of progressive investigative news outlet that's been doing a lot of great work. Former speechwriter for the Bernie campaign, former Hill staffer, all sorts of different hats. I don't know if I've told this story on here. I first met David in the spring of 2003 when I was a student in David Broder's journalism class at the University of Maryland. And what David Broder would do, he would just, instead of having to teach, he would just bring people in that he respected to have them talk to the class. And one of the people he brought in was a Democratic Hill staffer named David Sirota. Do you remember?
I do remember.
Speaking to his class?
I do. He drove me over to the class. He picked me up on Capitol Hill in his little car and drove me over to the class. And, you know, for folks who don't know, David Broder was the so-called dean of the Capitol Hill Washington Press Corps.
For like decades.
For decades, yeah. So it was kind of an interesting kind of honor to be asked to go speak to his class. I was sort of shocked about it. I was working on the House Appropriations Committee when George Bush was president and the Iraq War was happening. And because there were a lot of spending fights, we had become one of the few places that were really putting up any kind of a public fight with the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11 and the Iraq War. It was a really stifling time on Capitol Hill and in Washington where, you know, the sort of worship of the wartime president was at its peak. And our little team at the House Appropriations Committee, where the president still had to come and ask for money to spend, we were trying to put up the good fight.
And one of my memories of that class was that David Broder used to answer his phone in the middle of class. This was David Broder. And it was a lesson I took with me. He had no idea who it was. A lesson in journalism I took with me, just always answer your phone.
Because the problem with that lesson right now, by the way.
It doesn't work anymore, really. And I don't follow that anymore.
The problem is that the spam calling on a cell phone, you don't know whether you're answering it. And if you answer the spam phone call, then it encourages them to put you on another spam list because you answered your phone. So,
and that's why
my phone is,
I get so many spam calls because up until maybe a year and a half ago, I still stuck by that Broderism of answer the phone because you never know who might be calling you. So So you got nominated for an Oscar for best story. I mean, it got a ton of Oscar nominations, right? For a variety of different things.
Right. Four Oscar nominations, best picture, best screenplay, best film editing, and best musical score.
And so that meant you got to go to the Oscars, and I'm fascinated by what that kind of cultural experience is like. So, like, first of all, who does every single nominee get a seat in the Oscars? How big is the place? Or are there politics about, you know, who gets the seats? I mean, clearly there are politics about where you get a seat, because it, you know, Will Smith is right there, like 7 feet away, you know, from Chris Rock. But does everybody go, or how does that work?
So I believe every nominee is invited with a plus one. So I got to go with my wife, Emily. And then I requested a couple more tickets. The good news is I got four other tickets. I brought my parents. I brought my brother-in-law and his wife. And it was a grand old time. I think I was told that there's about 2,000 or 3,000 seats in the Dolby Theater. So it's a really giant theater. We got to sit I was sitting sort of probably two or three effectively rows behind Will Smith in the center. They had us at sort of tables. And I think they created the table system after during the pandemic to keep people spread out. But yeah, we were right on the floor, and amid, you know, all of these stars and celebrities. And it was, I definitely felt like a stranger in a strange land, a kind of fish out of water, but it was one hell of an experience.
Are the celebrities in a way fascinated by you? You know, because if there's a bunch of fish that are all the same, and then all of a sudden there's a different fish, like this guy who's involved in politics and investigative journalism, or no, they're like, if you're not in Hollywood, they almost can't see you unless you have a tray with a drink on it or something.
Right. I mean, it's definitely it's kind of like DC in the sense that it's a one company town or a one industry town. I was told a long time ago that when I started dipping my toe into the Hollywood world, that some people would find it particularly interesting that I worked in politics, because that's something different. And Hollywood is kind of fascinated with Washington and politics, and vice versa, by the way. You know, Washington is sort of fascinated with Hollywood. So, you know, I mean, there's one line I heard said to me was that, you know, if Washington is Hollywood for ugly people, as the phrase goes, Hollywood is politics for beautiful people. There's a lot of politics going on in Hollywood about basically everything, right? I mean, like, from everything from where do people get to sit at the Oscars to who gets nominated, there's politicking to who wins the Oscars. I mean, these are all little political worlds. But I will say, one thing that stood out to me in this whole process, and granted, I've only been part of this process for 1 year, but it got me thinking, which was that our movie was kind of, it's not a real apples to apples movie with the other movies that were there, in this sense that our movie was explicitly political. It was explicitly in the here and now. And if you look at most of the other films that were nominated, most of those films are very different from that. They're not really explicitly political. A lot of them are set in the past. It's not to make a judgment about that, but I did have a feeling going into the Oscars that, you know, our movie was quite a bit different from the norm of the movies represented at the Oscars. And I think that's kind of interesting, in the sense that we're living through unbelievably political times right now. We're living through a moment of, I would argue, existential crises when it comes to the climate, when it comes to the pandemic and the like. And there weren't that many movies represented at the Oscars that were kind of struggling with negotiating with, wrestling with the here and now of politics and the divisive issues of the day right now. And I don't know exactly what the takeaway from that is, but I think that's clear.
Yeah, and politics now is so much more even personal and emotional than it was, say, in like the 1990s. There was a recent survey that said that, you know, there are a vastly increasing number of people, you know, would refuse to date people from a different political party, which is kind of a new, I don't know if it's new, but it's like, it's different than it was a couple decades ago. And so in a polarized environment like that, if you go in with a movie that is going to be loved by kind of one side, then it's going to be hated by the other side, which cuts your audience down. Hollywood might want to say, well, let's just do stuff that's in the past or in a fantasy land. And I'm curious, was that a topic of conversation among like the artists and writers and actors that you were with throughout this? How long were you out there? Like a week or less? Or
yeah, I was there for a week. I mean, I think that's right. I think if politics is now seen as personal identity in a way that it wasn't necessarily in the past. In other words, I'm this or that party, and that's how I organize my self-perception and organize my life,
right,
and who
represents your values, and right,
exactly. Then what that encourages, I think, in decisions about cultural programming is risk aversion. Okay, we want to make cultural products that don't even get into that, because if we want the widest possible audience, then if we take a side politically, it alienates us from one part of the audience. And so I'm not saying that's the way I think about it. I'm saying I think that's the way a lot of some of the folks who run the cultural industries think about things, because they're thinking about how to make sure their cultural products reach the broadest audience. And so what the effect of it is in practice is cultural products that don't necessarily struggle with those issues for fear of political controversy, for fear of alienating a piece of the audience. And so when I was out there and talking to folks about this, one piece of feedback was that Adam McKay, the great Adam McKay, my friend and collaborator and just an all-around fantastic guy, that he's the guy who has figured out how to do movies, television shows, and the like, that do explicitly deal with political issues. He's kind of the go-to guy for that. The feedback is that Adam's the one who can do that stuff, and it's harder for others to do the kinds of things that he does. So that's in a sense, it's sort of his lane, quote unquote. But of course, the downside of that, and it's fantastic, it's great for Adam, but the downside of that is that it's sort of like, well, if Adam's doing it, then the rest of the industry doesn't have to do it, because
right,
he's got
McKay's
it.
Got
so,
that.
So he's supposedly got it covered. Yeah, he's got that. That's McKay. And what's frustrating about that is that no, like everybody should be doing that. We need more content that is struggling with the here and now, that is making the audience uncomfortable, or at least wrestling with issues that make the audience uncomfortable. The idea that one guy's got it and everyone else should go over here and do other stuff that doesn't wrestle with that stuff, I just think that's not serving what the audience wants and needs. And I would argue that the success, the popular success of Don't Look Up, you know, the second most watched film on the world's largest streaming platform, second only to Red Notice, the movie with The Rock and Ryan Reynolds, a kind of adventure action movie. The fact that a kind of climate movie even got close to, you know, a blockbuster, a movie like that, I would argue that suggests there's a huge pent-up demand and huge potential audience for films and television shows that do explicitly struggle with issues that are scary, that are in the here and now. And again, I think the reason that our movie elicited such a reaction, and I knew it was going to elicit a big reaction, but some people loved it, some people hated it, is because when you're struggling with the here and now, everybody has a passionate opinion about the here and now. In contrast to, you may not have a strong opinion about movies and television shows set, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
Like Henry VIII.
Yeah, like you may not, right, exactly. You may not have like a really passionate political response to that. But if you're talking about, you know, how does the president and Congress deal with an emergency, and that's a movie about that or a satire about that, you're going to have probably some kind of serious opinion.
And I wonder if his particular politics play into this a little bit. I mean, on the one hand, he's obviously kind of has a unique talent that he brings to, you know, all the different projects he does, but also Hollywood is, you know, fair. And tell me if the stereotype is correct, having, you know, been in it now for a little bit, that it's just kind of partisan Democrat, like that it's kind of a superficial, we're Democrats and not going much deeper than that. Whereas McKay has always been willing to criticize Democrats as well as criticize Republicans. And Don't Look Up is no different. Like, you know, everybody comes in for criticism there, including the protagonists of the film. Like the scientists, you know, have all sorts of problems that he sends up, that you both send up as well. So do you think it's his willingness to go after Democrats as well and liberals as well in some of the other shows that
I would broaden it a little bit and say it's nominally Democrat. It's however you want to characterize it, the kind of left of center MSNBC liberal middle, right? Mm-hmm. The kind of he has produced movies, television shows, and the like, which don't just indict the right, although he does that plenty. I mean, you mm-hmm. watch Vice, one of my favorite movies, and there's a lot about the, you know, obviously it's all about the neocons and the like. But yes, he's somebody who's willing to have a political analysis that shows the complicity of the sort of center of the Democratic Party, the kind of liberal a power elite that runs the Democratic Party. And I put liberal in quotes because I'm not actually sure how liberal or left that part of our politics are. But I think that is the part of politics that doesn't get a lot of criticism, and that the criticism is received in a lot of ways as it's not accepted all that well, because it can be easily framed as you're helping the Republicans, right? I mean, I think that's the world we live in now, which is stifling in this sense that our politics have become so tribalized. You're either a Democrat or you're a Republican, that it has, especially on the Democratic side, it has made it much more difficult to have an analysis outside of that, let's say a progressive or left anchored analysis of politics, without being accused of helping the far right. It's kind of like we live in a world where the argument that was made about Ralph Nader in the 2000 election, oh, you helped elect George Bush, has now become baked into how people view politics, Democratic politics. If you are a Bernie Sanders, if you are the Squad, if you are an activist or an organization criticizing the Democratic Party from the proverbial left, you're actually making common cause with the right, as the argument goes. I mean, I reject that argument, but I think our culture is so sensitive to that argument that's why, in a sense, why McKay's work is in part seen as so controversial, because he's willing to make that analysis. And I would argue that analysis is correct. That analysis, his analysis is honest and real. Like, if you can't admit that the corrupt center of the Democratic Party is part of the problem on so many issues, then you're not being honest with how the world works. I mean, not to get too far afield here, but if you can't look at something like, you know, student debt, or drug prices right now and look at the center of the Democratic Party, Joe Biden, refusing to sign executive orders to cancel student debt, reduce student debt, or lower prescription drug prices. If you can't admit that and you think somebody mentioning that is somehow disloyal and helping the Republicans, then you're not living in reality. And I think McKay's work, and I think our movie, Don't Look Up, is aimed at presenting or at least criticizing the, in part, the reality of that situation, which of course is going to elicit a particularly strong reaction. And I'll just add one other thing. I think it elicits an even stronger reaction than if you just criticize the right. That yes, the American right is hostile to critiques of its ideology, certainly, but that the center of the Democratic Party is just as hostile to honest criticism of its corruption as the American right is to criticism of its extremism and corruption.
And how invested are people in kind of defending the center of the party out in Hollywood? Because I could see it going either way, but to me it seems like for some of them, it's just a, like the way that in, say, the former Soviet Union or in China, like if you rise to a certain level, you just join the Chinese Communist Party. Like that's kind of what you do. Like it doesn't mean you kind of have bought into all of the politics and ideology of it, but like to rise through the ranks, that's what you do. So yeah, and if that's the kind of looseness of the connection that people feel with it, I could see why it would be easier to just say, you know what, let's just skip all this anyway, because I don't really feel like dealing with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the top of the industry, and we're speaking broadly here, but I think at the top of the entertainment industry, there are a lot of folks who are real big D Democratic Party kind of people at the very top.
Big amounts of money to I think across the country, and yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those are right. Those are big D Democrats. I think a lot of them, their political analysis doesn't go much farther than you know, the Democrats are, if not good, they're the rational, quote unquote, normal party, and the Republicans are extremists and
they're going to follow science
off the deep end. But I right, exactly. But I also think that just because you're a big D Democrat in the context of politics today doesn't mean your ideology is particularly progressive. Especially on like economic issues or stuff like, you know, unions or regulation and the like. I think it's just the Democratic Party is in a sense one of the two parties of big business. So I think if you're at the top of one of the biggest businesses in America and you're a Democrat, it doesn't mean you're some, you know, Bernie Sanders Democrat or the like. It can mean you're, you know, you've chosen one of the two big business parties to affiliate with. But I will say this, I think at the rank and file, quote unquote, talent level, what I mean by that is not the executives, not the folks running the industry, but the actors and the screenwriters and the producers and the like. Look, I think I've met a lot of people who wanted to talk to me about what it was like to be Bernie Sanders' press secretary, and way back and speechwriter on his presidential campaign. I met a lot of folks who definitely don't seem satisfied with the Democratic Party and who have a much more progressive analysis of where they believe the country should be going and a lot of dissatisfaction with where it is going. And so I do think there's kind of a tension between the folks who make movies and television shows, the artists, and the industry. And so I think what's great about McKay is that he exists in a space where he's been able to actually make cultural products at scale and bring in incredibly well-known and talented artists, actors, and the like, to produce those cultural products, and the industry, I think, has supported him because the products are successful. I mean, ultimately, that is how the folks at the top of the industry are judging things, which is in some ways, it's like an apolitical judgment. Hey, if this TV show or movie is successful, that's good for the bottom line. And so that's a success. And so success begets success. So all of McKay's past movies that have been so commercially successful have helped create the space for him to do more of that. In some ways, it's kind of like he hacked the system. Like he found like a glitch in the matrix, and so it was a real
it's profit,
right? Yeah, exactly. So it's like you know, like it was such a thrill to be able to work with somebody who has found the glitch in the matrix, right? I mean, I started out with Don't Look Up. I couldn't believe the movie was actually going to be made. Like, I remember saying that to him. I cannot believe a movie that says what we're saying is actually going to be made on a huge platform. And ultimately, the reason it was made was because, A, he's an amazing scriptwriter and an amazing director. And B, I think that Netflix wasn't making a political judgment. They were saying Adam McKay is successful. He's got a great script. He's a great filmmaker. And this is going to be a kind of a bottom line success for us. And so McKay, he came to the table saying, you know, I want to make this movie. It's an important message. And so the sort of Venn diagram is, you know, Netflix's interest of we want to make a successful product, and McKay's interest in I want to make a successful product that has a set of political messages that may be controversial, but I believe are important. Like, they found agreement, and that is a glitch in the matrix.
And he wound up getting half the tables near the front of the stage seemed probably had an actor who was in Don't Look Up.
Right.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Were you there for, or how did the slap go down? It was, you had left the room or something at that point, right?
Yes. So they had just announced the winners and losers of the screenplay awards, the adapted and original. And I want to be very clear about this. And McKay and I talked a lot about this, that we were prepared to go into the Oscars up until about a week before the Oscars, knowing and thinking that we had absolutely no chance to win. We were shocked that we got nominated in the sense of the politics of our movie. The Academy is not often not interested in platforming sort of explicitly political movies. So we were shocked and happy that we got nominated. But we were prepared to go in there thinking, "Hey, we literally have no chance to win any awards at all. It's great to be nominated, but we just don't have any chance." Then, about a week before the Oscars, we won. Adam and I won for best original screenplay from the Writers Guild, the WGA, which is a huge award. I mean,
because
it's a really,
the writers.
And I was completely shocked. But it's like a big deal award. So Adam and I talked about this, about how it kind of messed with our minds, because it was like, that was awesome to win the WGA award for original screenplay. But it also was like, wait a minute, I wonder if we have a chance to win the Oscar, right? Like it kind of got into our minds. So when we didn't win, by the way, we practiced all week. He and I practiced all week with each other, making our faces look happy when we didn't win. right? Like we actually practiced that. And actually we told Paul Thomas Anderson that
what's the key?
You have to literally practice looking happy when you're not happy. Right. So like literally, and we told Paul Thomas Anderson this, he was sitting right next to us because the buzz was Licorice Pizza was going to win. And Licorice Pizza didn't win, by the way. So after Licorice Pizza didn't win, we told Paul Thomas Anderson, we were sort of commiserating with him. We said to him, like, listen, Adam and I were practicing, like, and the winner is Licorice Pizza. And Adam and I would clap and look happy. That's how we practiced. And we told Paul Thomas Anderson that. I'm not sure it made him feel any better. but anyway, that's a long way of saying Belfast wins.
And the Oscar goes to
Kenneth Branagh, Belfast.
So Adam and I, you know, practiced, you know, we were clapping and looking happy, and Coda won for best adapted screenplay. And so me, Adam, Maggie Gyllenhaal, and Peter Sarsgaard went out. Peter Sarsgaard is Maggie's husband. We went outside, out to the bar for a drink to sort of, you know, just the announcement had made, take the edge off, have a drink. We were having a drink. And we were actually kind of talking about how weird the Oscars were, in the sense of like there hadn't up until that point been much mention of kind of the outside world, like what's going on in the world. It was a very, you know, very Oscar-ish kind of show. And I had never been to one. And you know, I think we had said something, you know, sort of about, you know, where are the politics in this show? Like, there's been no mention of climate change or anything. And it's, you know, and all of a sudden we hear somebody came up to us and said, you know, something like Will Smith had slapped Chris Rock.
Oh, wow. Wow. Will Smith just smacked the shit out of me.
And like if you hear that, you don't even know what it means, right? Like if you haven't seen the video clip and somebody says that and you're at the Oscars, it doesn't really make, like, what does that even mean? He slapped, like, that doesn't make sense, right? So and then it was like the video, something about it was on delay, it didn't go out on TV, or in theory it didn't go out on TV. So we went back in a little while later, and what was bizarre to me was that, so then we see Will Smith get named best actor, and he gives this speech where he's crying and sort of blubbering.
Now, I know to do what we do, you got to be able to take abuse. You got to be able to have people talk crazy about you. In this business, you got to be able to have people disrespecting you. And you got to smile and you got to pretend like that's okay.
And he's obviously making reference to what had just happened.
I want to apologize to the Academy. I want to apologize to all my fellow nominees.
But we didn't, it was like hard to understand what he was referencing because we hadn't seen it. We're like trapped in this bubble. And it was just so weird that all happened. And I'm getting like my phone is like blowing up. Oh my God, were you there for the slap? And I had to basically admit to people I wasn't even there. I was like, you know, I should have been 10 feet away, but I was out sort of out at the bar feeling bad, drinking with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard and Adam. You know, we weren't even there. And actually, Peter texted me when I texted him. I was like, man, it was like afterwards I texted him and I was like, it's really hilarious. We were outside at the bar kind of lamenting, what was going on at the show and sort of lack of politics and the like, while the biggest moment of the show was unfolding, which was two celebrities essentially fighting with each other. And he basically texted back and said, yeah, it was perfect timing to go get a drink.
And so, like, my understanding, there was like a standing ovation for Will Smith when he's giving his speech. And so now here you are, there's a standing ovation, but you don't really understand what is being ovated. Like, what are people celebrating? It's all confusion. Like, how do you handle that situation? Do you stay seated? You stand up because you're like, well, everybody else is standing up. I guess I gotta stand up. Like, what was that moment like?
Honestly, I can't remember. I can't remember if I stood up or not, but I do remember not knowing what was going on. Like I was confused about why Will Smith was crying, and his speech. Yeah. Like honestly, I haven't even gone back and watched it, but his speech seemed. If you didn't know what had just happened 30 minutes ago, then his speech doesn't make it seems like totally incoherent. So I didn't know what was going on, but in retrospect, it's totally bizarre. The sort of the slap happened. And then it was like as if nothing happened. And then he goes up and he wins and everyone's cheering. Like, I'm not exactly like, listen, 2020 hindsight. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, there's a good argument to be made. He should have been removed or there should have been some intervention or something.
Did you see anybody come up to him?
No, I mean, Denzel Washington made some reference. He was sort of, I think he sort of like said something to him on the stage. But it wasn't like he was all of a sudden radioactive in that room after mm-hmm. that happened. Like it was like physically, like meaning like it was just like the show went on. I mean, it was like literally like the show must go on. So it was, you know, like if you hadn't seen, like if you were like me, if you hadn't seen what had happened and you came back into the theater, you'd just think, oh, it's just nothing happened. Right. Like it's just the show continues, which is kind of really in retrospect is kind of insane.
I heard somebody speculate that everybody was applauding him because of the power dynamic that you talked about, that like he's going to keep making huge movies and people want to be close to the people that are at the very top. And so it's not Stalinist, like, you know, there was this joke in Soviet Russia that, you know, the person who stopped clapping first, you know, was going to get like dragged out by like Stalin's goons. And so they would, you know, he would be applauded for like 45 minutes, like people like just falling over in exhaustion, applauding, that there was a similar version of it.
Well, listen, I mean, the power dynamic is real in this sense. Had I gone up on stage and slapped Chris Rock, I would be in a jail cell, right? I would have been dragged away immediately, right? Like, so obviously there's a power dynamic in that sense. And I think there's also like, look, Will Smith knows everybody there. I mean, and I should step back and say this, that one thing that's interesting, not surprising, is that everybody in that room knows everybody, right? I mean, I felt like a fish out of water in the sense I knew nobody in that room. So, but everybody has worked with everybody. So everybody is essentially familiar. Mm-hmm. It's like a small town. Everybody's familiar with everybody. So in some ways, there's like this casualness about it. So Will Smith is like, you know, a guy who's been in the small town forever. And so I don't know if there was kind of eye rolling or what. There was sort of a vibe of like, this is a family mm-hmm. spat. This is not a big, you know, international, you know, moment on television in front of a billion people. But yes, the power dynamic is such that had it been someone else who did that, I think the reaction would have been very different. And Will Smith really is like an institution in Hollywood, and he's been an institution in Hollywood for decades. Now, I will say, I you know, one thing that's fascinating to me about this is that Will Smith has been, if not angling for, he's been in the orbit of getting an Oscar for decades. And what's incredible to me is that 30 minutes, 40 minutes before he's about to finally get the Oscar that he's been in the orbit of for 30 years, he has this, I don't know if it's a breakdown or just he cracks or, and I kind of wondered, this is, and to be clear, this is not to absolve him at all. What he did was outrageous and unacceptable. But I kind of wonder how much the pressure of the moment and the anticipation of the moment was also at play in his reaction. In other words, no matter how big a star you are in Hollywood, when you're in that room and you're waiting to see if you're going to win the Oscar, you can tell that pressure, that anticipation, that anxiety is, I mean, it is all throughout that room, no matter how big a star you are. You could sort of sense that. And so I just think it's interesting because you think like Will Smith has been famous in a huge Hollywood institution forever.
Who cares
about, does he really care about getting an Oscar? I mean, like it would be right. But like one thing that I have learned from the Oscar experience, not a huge revelation, is that the Oscars do this incredible job of like building up their importance. Like from the moment I was named a nominee, it was, you know, there's all this messaging about the history of being a nominee, and you've joined this sort of an incredible, you know, 95 year history. So they do a really amazing job of sort of creating a self-perception of the significance of being a nominee and winning an Oscar. And I think, and it's kind of amazing that you can tell that is understood and gets into the psyche of even the biggest stars.
It says something interesting about humanity and the human condition too, that, you know, there's this idea that neoliberalism has tried to inject into the bloodstream that money is the only thing that really can motivate people, but it's not true.
No. Like, I mean, money mostly.
People are much deeper than that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, money makes the world go round, but power and status, which are obviously related to money, are also huge forces. And the Oscars are, in Hollywood, are considered the ultimate form of status. Now, I want to be clear. Like, getting the WGA award is as meaningful to me as being an Oscar nominee, or if we had won, winning an Oscar, because the writers, that is an award from the best, the most successful best writers in that industry, given to other writers. But the WGA is obviously not as well known, and in a strange way is not as quote unquote prestigious, whatever that word means, as an Oscar, because. And if you start really unpacking why that is, it's really fascinating how the Oscars have kind of created, how the Academy has created this thing that's kind of intangible, but is so powerful, right? I mean, the Academy Award, think about how, you know, somebody said to me, they said, in your obituary, you can have four, there are four or five cultural labels that will exist in your obituary if you ever get them. And it's, you know, a Nobel Prize, a knighthood, arguably the Pulitzer Prize, and an Oscar or an Oscar nomination is on there. And what's interesting is you start asking, well, why is that? And it's actually hard to answer that question. Right. Like, I'm not even sure why exactly that is. But in one sense, it's kind of a credit to the Academy for their skill in kind of creating this talisman, this award that is so well known and kind of revered for reasons that are hard to explain.
Right. It kind of is because it is.
Exactly. I mean, and like, just as like a somebody who works in politics and, you know, worked on campaigns, I kind of marvel at the brilliance of that, because it's like a Jedi mind trick. I mean, the funny thing is that you can ask my wife this, I was not caught up in this at all. Like, I was like, I'm like, that's amazing to be a nominee, and it's incredible, and I can't believe the movie got made. And by the time they were announcing who won the nomination, I was like, I really hope we win. And then inside my brain, I'd be like, why do I care if we win? Right. Like, I don't even know why I care. I can't answer why I care.
Yep. They win. So was this a one time? Well, not one time, but is this a dalliance with Hollywood? We got another project. What's your relationship now with this industry? Are you going to be thinking of another project?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a couple projects that are in the works. I have no idea if they're going to go forward. That's one thing. One thing I've learned about Hollywood is whether something is going to happen or not. Changes can change every day, can actually change every hour. So, the way to survive, I think, in that world is to put as many irons in the fire as possible and hope one comes back. So I've got a couple, and I should say they all deal with politics. I mean, and sort of the issues of the day. I mean, I certainly will say this for myself, which is that I don't want to do movies, television shows, and the like if they're just kind of frivolous stuff or escapist kind of stuff. If I'm going to work in and around that industry a little bit. I want it to be based on my values and my politics. And I should add that in some ways, that'll probably, if I end up doing more work in Hollywood, that'll probably limit the opportunities. But I'm okay with that because, I mean, this is why I love Adam McKay so much. He inspires me in the sense of somebody who's willing to infuse their work in that industry with his values, knowing that can make the path more difficult. But as I kind of go back to this old quote that I've been thinking a lot about from politics lately, and it's a Lyndon Johnson quote, and it's the quote of, "What the hell is the presidency for?" And that was Johnson basically talking to his advisors about the Civil Rights Act, and they were sort of saying, maybe you shouldn't push it forward now. And he said, well, I mean, the thrust of the comment is, what's the point of being in this office if not to do these kinds of things? And I kind of think about that. I think there's actually a deeper lesson in that for everybody who does any of this work, which is if you're working in and around politics, or you're in journalism, or you're in Hollywood, what's the point of doing that work if you're not going to infuse it with your values? Yes, it's going to make your path harder. That's a sacrifice I'm willing to make if I can, you know, as long as I can sort of survive, then I'm willing to, you know, limit opportunities if that's the cost of having the work be based on your values. And I think it was, by the way, there's another, I'm not sure if this is an apocryphal story or not, but I've heard this story told a couple times about another guy in Hollywood, the recently departed Ed Asner, a great, amazing actor with great politics. And as the story goes, somebody asked him, "Hey, why are you so political? Like, why are you going out and helping these movements and using your platform to kind of push progressive causes when you know that may cause controversy, may make it harder for you to work as an actor?" And as the story goes, his response is, I do that because I want to be able to get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror. I want to be able to know that I'm not just sort of selling out or focused on myself. I'm here to do things that are based on my values. And I think that's why Adam McKay is such an inspiration to me, is that is somebody who is at the top of a enormously powerful industry, who has been willing to use his political capital in that industry to make things that aren't just entertaining, although they certainly are entertaining, but to infuse them with values, knowing that is going to cause controversy and the like.
And at the same time, what's it been like watching the rollout of the film and then the reaction to it? You know, it's the initial reaction started out all this conversation about Adam McKay and his beef with Will Ferrell, instead of focus on this movie, which is about the way, you know, that culture trivializes existential threats, and then it ends with multi-day conversation about Will Smith slapping Chris Rock on stage while it's like 70 degrees in the North Pole.
I know. I said to McKay at one point, I said, it kind of feels like we're Randall Mindy and Kate DiBiase. Like it's like we're the two, like there, it's like a meta version of our movie unfolded with the release and promotion of our movie. I put it out there, the speech that I had in my pocket, and folks can find it at levernews.com. I put out this little speech, right? And by the way, they told you at the Oscar nominees lunch to make the speech really short. So some folks have emailed me being like, was that really all you were going to say? And I was like, listen, they tell you at the very beginning, if you win, you
play have that music.
30 seconds to say. So it's basically you have one line of thank yous and one line of whatever you want to say. And what I was going to say, if we had actually won, I was going to say, everybody in this room has an absolutely enormous amount of power. Every single person in that room, all the nominees, all that industry has so much power. Please use that power to sound the alarm for climate action. You know, the comet is coming. I didn't get to say that. And to be honest, that was the biggest disappointment for me, was not getting a statue. It was that I really wanted folks to hear that. And instead, the takeaway from the entire award show is this fight between celebrities. And it, I think the entire experience, the positive way of spinning it is that the entire experience of releasing and promoting the movie kind of proved the accuracy of the depiction of the movie's depiction of the world. Yes. That we're fighting this, you know, we're fighting to get the climate message out there. And, you know, it starts with Will, you know, a Will Ferrell controversy, and ends with a, you know, this thing about, you know, with Chris Rock and Will Smith. I would argue that, you know, Don't Look Up's depiction of the world was proven by our experience. I think the, you know, the kind of negative and spin take on that is if you can't get the message out, or if the message is suppressed or kind of blocked on a movie that had, you know, hundreds of millions of people watch it, and it's still that experience, you can kind of wonder, is any message going to get out? I mean, the negative side of my brain says we just made a huge movie, and did it make any impact? No pun intended. The other part of me is like, you know, the whole award show circuit and the like is easy to distract you from the impact it did make, right? I mean, I kept saying, and I believe ultimately that whether we won this or that award or didn't win this award, that award, or how cool it was to be nominated or we didn't win the Oscar, the success of the movie is hundreds of millions of people watching it, is the climate movement using Don't Look Up or Just Look Up as a clarion call. That's the true success of the movie. And that's way bigger than any award.
Right. And I think it gave people a language to decode what they're seeing in the real world, like the Don't Look Up, Just Look Up are good examples. So, as you know, if you're looking at the fossil fuel industry's propaganda around climate change, and you know, you could try to dissect and deconstruct that in an intellectual level, or you can say, that's like the guy who says he's for the jobs the comet's going to bring, and boom, exactly. you understand it right there. And giving exactly. people that ability to understand it in the same way that Dr. Strangelove, you know, gave it to the kind of the symbol.
And I will say one other thing that I really enjoyed about the whole Oscar experience, and maybe I'm deluded, maybe not, but one of the reactions that I most consistently received from actors, from other directors, when I, you know, at the governor's ball, after the Oscars, was essentially some version of thank you for making this movie. In other words, it wasn't just, hey, your movie was great, or hey, I really liked your movie. It was essentially thank you for doing this particular movie. And what I take away from that is that there are a lot of artists and people working in Hollywood who appreciated that we made a movie that did lean into the climate message and the message about science, and that there was almost an appreciation for how rare that is, and an appreciation that we managed to pull it off on such a big scale. So that's encouraging to me in the sense of, the reaction wasn't like, oh, you guys are weirdos, or you guys are like, you know, it was almost like a whispered, like, man, thanks so much for doing that. Right. Which says to me, there's not only an audience appetite for this kind of content, but I think there's an appetite among the creatives in Hollywood to do this kind of thing, and an interest in doing more of it. So my hope moving forward is that same message I was going to say in the if we had won the Oscar, which is like, let's do more of this. We just proved that it can be commercially successful, so let's do more. So if one of the legacies of the movie is to help create the space for more Adam McKays, right? Like 15, 20 other Adam McKays who make movies like this, that would be a huge accomplishment as well.
Yeah. And I think it makes us all feel a little bit less crazy. And so I'll say it too. Thank you for making this. Made me feel less crazy watching it unfold like that. And congratulations. It is, as they say, it's an honor just to be nominated. And thank you for joining me here on Deconstructed.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by William Stanton. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, DC bureau chief of The Intercept. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. If you enjoy this podcast, be sure to also check out Intercepted, as well as Murderville, which is now in its second season. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. And please go leave us a review or a rating, or both. It helps people find the show. If you want to give us additional feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much. See you soon.
To The View.
This is
crazy. So y'all are up.
I thought Zendaya killed it in her two-piece Valentino. I mean, she was fantastic. Jada Pinkett Smith, I think she looks gorgeous.
Keep my wife's name out your fucking mouth. Yes.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.